Rainer was to go to the UK conference. He can start without you. Remember, morning, commissioner, morning devotee, Pedro advisor, Abba Chesterton, CEO, Aska and Aspa, CEO, and everyone who is here. Members will start with the South African Post Office State Owned Companies and CTG. Then after that, they will go to the NCC. So that if they are members who have other commitments, they can be able to go to the court. Thank you. That's why we got the young lions with us, so that they can remind us the old, that's what we have forgotten. Welcome to the office. Members, I hope you all have the necessary documents. We'll be using the one which is the title is South African Post Office SOCNCDD, which is State Owned Company Limited. Down there is got the text FB2B2010. I'm not sure whether we already have the right one. So that's the one we should be using to go to the formal process. Members, we start with the cover page one, the one with the title. I assume that the members had enough time to go through. They know where they've got the issue, but we've not received any. I will assume that they are not the heading is called duties of court office perform. Page 5, powers of court office clause 5. Performance agreement of court office and subsidiary clause 6. Page 6, government support to court office and loans by court office and subsidiaries, which is clause 7. Board of the court office clause 8. Function of the board clause 9. Disqualification for membership of the board and his clause 10, which continue to page 7. Appointment of non-executive board members, clause 11. Page 8, resignation, removal from office and vacancies, clause 12. Page 9. Judicial duties of the board members, clause 18. Procedures at meetings and committees of the board, clause 14. Delegation and assignment of functions by the board, clause 15. Appointment of chief executive officer, chief financial officer, and chief operating officer, clause 15. Page 11, condition of appointment of chief executive officer, chief financial officer, and chief operating officer, clause 17. Termination of employment of chief executive officer, chief financial officer, and chief operating officer, clause 18. Acting chief executive officer, chief financial officer, or chief operating officer, clause 19. Page 12, delegation by chief executive officer, chief financial officer, and chief operating officer, clause 20. Personnel of court office, clause 21. Subsidiaries and accountability, clause 22. Application of Public Finance Management Act, clause 23. Investigation of court office, clause 24. Intervention by the minister, clause 25. Page 14, limitation of liability, clause 26. Application of Companies Act to Post Office, clause 27. Certain provision of Companies Act may be declared inapplicable to Post Office, clause 28. Regulations and policies, clause 29. Offenses and penalties, clause 80. Repeal and amendment of laws, clause 81. The short title and commencement, clause 82. Page 17, schedule 1, 13, 21, 5. Page 17. Page 18, schedule 2, section 31, laws repealed or amended. That will continue. Page 19, page 20, page 21, page 22, page 24, page 25, page 26, page 27, page 28, page 29, page 30, page 31, page 32. Memorandum of the object of the South African Court Office Bill 2010. The background, the current regulatory framework, which is clause 2, clause 3, object of the bill, for summary of the bill, continue page 35, clause 5, parties consulted, 6, financial implication for states, 7, implication for provinces, 8, parliamentary procedure. And the final page. I will read the report. Committee report report of the Portfolio Committee on Communication on the South African Post Office Bill B2-2010, National Assembly, Section 75, dated 15 June 2011. The Portfolio Committee on Communication has been considered the subject of the South African Post Office Bill B2-2010, National Assembly, Section 75, referred to it and classified by the Joint Tagging Mechanism, JTM, as Section 75 Bill before the Bill with Amendment. Agreed? That concludes the formal adoption of the bill. Any mover? Honorable Zondi, and the ANC Youth League member, Honorable Morotowa, second. So I shall say. Thank you. The one issue, members, which we need to pass is that since it's a consensus thing, whether we have to debate it in the House or it will go in a form of a report, we have to agree on that so that the necessary arrangement is made. I can see the aid not here, copy not here, IFT is here. Can I get the views of the party? And this Matazi and Zaza.
Thank you.
for the sin can have been told who has actually deceived me. Only if there is any guilt from but I can see members here too. If this is a great so that confused me. But she says I might talk, so I'm just looking for her sake. And thanks, Honorable Deacon. My reading that the committee is saying firstly that I must talk to the opposition who is not here and get their views. But we love that we have the debate, but we go for the shortest time. The debate, because we got the 30 minutes, we got the 45, we got the 60, we got the 90. Which if you say go for debate, you must choose which one you go. So I understand that we go for the shortest for giving the feedback. It is so accurate that we Thank you very much, Timothy. You see, accidentally, or I'm not sure how to call it, that the person looking for children is here. She's here. But on another capacity, and the bill is finalized today, she's here. Thanks very much. I'm sure you are witnessing what you have started. The process coming to finality. Thanks very much to all the federal advisors for the family who have traveled, legal service from Parliament, court office, members themselves in trying to make sure that the finality is successful for our own issues of the people. Thanks very much. We go to the second issue. The MCC presentation. Remember, yesterday we had two presentations from MBDA, ASPA, and ACA. During their presentation, they highlighted issues also which impact in terms of the work of the MCC. In relation of how are they going to collaborate, work together to a certain instance, but just to generally to understand how they are going to fit in around the broader issues of the MCC and so on. We are pleased that the Commission, within a short space of time, she managed to accept our request. To come and make a presentation before the committee so that she can be able to enlighten us around this particular matter. So we are most welcome, we are not new. You know the process, you understand the process.
Thank you very much,
Chairperson.
Thank you very much, first of all, I'd like to indicate that in preparing the presentation, I really mostly focused on the provision of the Consumer Protection Act because our focus is on issues around advertising and how the landscape has changed in the context of the Consumer Protection Act. So that has been really my emphasis. And I hope I will obviously touch on some of the issues that you see. We want some clarity on in relation to the other institutions that have a say and a role in relation to advertising. The nature of my presentation is that from slide 1 to 7, I'm just dealing with the background, just indicating what the role of the Commission is. So I'll go through that very quickly, just to give the committee and the honourable members a sense of what the role of the NCC is. Then from slide 8, I'll go into the detail of what the Consumer Protection Act provides in relation to issues of marketing, specifically in relation to advertising. The National Consumer Commission, as I'm sure you're all aware, is an institution that operates in the public service. It operates in the public service and it has jurisdiction throughout the Republic of South Africa and must exercise functions assigned to it in terms of the Act, the CPA or any other law, and we're expected to act in a cost-efficient and effective manner, and we are supposed to follow the principles of the Constitution in relation to Section 196. The Commission has the responsibility of enforcing the Act, which is really twofold from where we sit. It is in relation to dealing with complaints from the public in relation to any economic activity that may take place where they're unhappy about the quality of service or the product that they receive. The second level of our mandate is in relation to advocacy, which is obviously creating public awareness around consumer issues and making that sure that consumers are properly acquainted with their rights and the issues and the powers that they have in relation to the Consumer Protection Act. What you see on the slide there really is all the formal steps that we utilize in order to meet those two principal mandates, which is that of complaints resolution and raising public awareness. Our objective really is to make sure that we have a fair, efficient, and transparent marketplace. We have consistent, predictable, and efficient regulatory environment. We provide effective redress to consumers in terms of the complaint resolution mechanisms that we have. We make sure that we promote a better customer service to the public and the private sector. I think I just need to pause on this specific issue. Just to indicate that the work that we do does have a lot of overlap in relation to what the public protector does and what the Human Rights Commission does, because we have jurisdiction to deal with complaints from consumers, whether it emanates from the private sector or the public sector, which means even when a consumer is not happy about what services they're receiving from government, the three tiers of government, they have every right to actually approach the commission, and we have jurisdiction to actually deal with those kinds of complaints. And to date, most of the complaints we have received are really in relation to local government and the services that are being provided by local government, but more especially in relation to the public crisis in housing and what is Johannesburg, and in relation to the refugee removal issue. So that's basically the area where we've received a lot of our complaints. We have also received a few complaints in relation to Department of Home Affairs with regard to delayed IEPs and issues of that nature. So there is obviously clearly an overlap there in relation to what those institutions do. But there's also the private sector overlap, which is in relation to all the other institutions that you've seen before this commission. And we are obliged in doing our work to take into account international best practices. The Act has basically got 7 chapters, which relate to basically interpretation, the preference of the policy and application of the Act, that's Chapter 1. Chapter 2 is the fundamental consumer rights. Chapter 3, because our legislation really is rights-based. So you'll see there from Chapter 2 right through to Chapter 6 really is about issues that relate to enforcement of specific rights that consumers have in terms of the Consumer Protection Act. And specifically, I think I would spend a lot of time dealing with Chapter 6 and Chapter 4 in relation to the provisions that exist in the advertising and marketing space. The application of the Act, I think I've already indicated that the Act applies across the board in relation to all transactions in the economic space. The one thing I think that's important for me to raise in relation to this particular slide in relation to the application of the Act is that the Act not only anticipates natural services of consumers, but even businesses, which is small to medium enterprises are also recognized as consumers in terms of the Act. So long as an entity can show that they have a turnover of $2 million or less, then they are entitled to actually bring a complaint against a supplier or a company in terms of the Consumer Protection Act. The areas in which we don't have jurisdiction is really in relation to labor matters, because it's understood that in the labor context there are established principles and rules that apply. We don't have jurisdiction in relation to credit agreements, meaning we don't have a jurisdiction in relation to the terms and conditions of a credit agreement. But if a person is unhappy about the goods or services that they receive in terms of a credit agreement, we do have jurisdiction. When you're unhappy about the terms and conditions of a credit agreement, you go to the National Credit Regulator. They are the ones that have exclusive jurisdiction in relation to that. We also don't have jurisdiction in relation to areas where the Minister of Trade and Industry has granted an exemption. Today, the Minister of Trade and Industry has only granted one exemption. He has given an exemption to low-capacity municipalities for an indefinite period to actually get their systems in place in order to meet the provisions of the Consumer Protection Act. But with all other municipalities, we have jurisdiction to deal specifically with the complaints and issues around that. Now, the issue around, before I go into the meat of the provisions, I think it's just important for me just indicate what a consumer is. In terms of the Act, a consumer is a user or beneficiary or a recipient of any good or service, except for in the industry that I mentioned, in relation to the labor industry and also in relation to credit agreements. But in all other industries, we have jurisdiction, and anybody who is a beneficiary, a user, or a recipient is entitled to do so. And the Act is very broad, and it refers to a user for one specific reason. That to find out, give an example, in the instance where you buy a product and your child is using it, they may not have been the actual purchaser of that product, but the still need to take into account the consumer protection act. So if they suffer any harm or disadvantage in relation to the use of that product, that child can still bring a complaint to the National Consumer Commission and would have jurisdiction to deal with it. Franchisees, as I indicated, these have specifically been isolated, and it is obviously franchisees in the that have a turnover of 2 million or less that would be able to bring complaints to the commission. And in relation to suppliers, I think I've already explained this issue that it is all private entities, including even government services or public entities, where the consumer is not happy about the value of service that they need. Now, to get into the issues that relate to marketing, I think I'd like to start with this slide specifically. Section 29 specifically states that where there is marketing of goods, the supplier must not market goods or services in a manner that is reasonably likely to imply any false or misleading representation concerning those particular goods or services. They must not give fraudulent or deceptive information in relation to the nature of the properties and the advantages of those goods, the manner and condition in which the goods and services will be supplied, the price at which those goods and services may be supplied, or even the sponsorship in relation to the event, and any material aspects in relation to that particular product. So the Act is very clear that it does maintain the rights of the consumer, and it makes sure that consumer has the right to a fair and responsible marketing by all entities that provide marketing services. Now, it also goes on to define specific types of products in relation to advertising and marketing, and then describes the manner in which suppliers are expected to actually conduct themselves. Now, if we go back to slide number 8, the first type of marketing that the Act identifies as being marketing that needs to be regulated in terms of the Act is in relation to direct marketing. Now, the Act specifically says that in relation to direct marketing, there is an obligation on the consumer has a right, before I go to the obligation, the consumer has a right to refuse to accept unwanted direct marketing, meaning that if you get a direct marketer calling you, you have the right to simply say, I am not interested in this direct marketing. You also have the right to require a marketer to actually discontinue providing you with marketing, even if while they're in the process of doing it. But the Act also creates a very important innovation, in the sense that it creates what is called a preemptive block, which means that the consumers can actually replace their name on the register, in terms of which, if they do not want to be contacted by direct marketers, then they can prohibit direct marketers from contacting them under any circumstances. But that register would have to be set up by the commission, updated by the commission regularly, in order to make sure that when before direct marketers contact consumers, they actually check on this register, check whether or not that consumer is listed on that register. If the consumer is listed, then they don't contact the consumer. If the consumer is not listed, only then can they approach that particular consumer from a direct marketing point of view. But the Act also does protect even those who have not been registered in terms of the preemptive block. It specifically states that in the instance where a consumer has not been registered in terms of the preemptive block, direct marketers cannot call you at all hours at any time of day and send you SMSs and emails as they wish. They are expected to, during weekdays from Monday to Fridays, to only contact a consumer from 8 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock in the evening, and then on Saturdays from 9 to 1 o'clock, and there is to be no contact with the consumer during Sundays and on public holidays. So there is clear regulation around the stipulated time in terms of which direct marketing can actually be undertaken by a specific institution in relation to a consumer. But even in the instance where a consumer does procure products through direct marketing, there are still strict regulations and stipulations around how that consumer can actually cancel or get out of that contract. The Act states that even after a product has been sold to a consumer through direct marketing, that consumer has the right to cancel that contract in writing and must do so within 5 business days of either receiving the goods or concluding the contract. This then obliges the supplier to return the payment of that consumer within 15 days of receiving that particular cancellation or receiving the goods back. And it specifically states that in terms of that the Act is subject to the Electronic Communications Act in this instance, because the timeline provided in the Electronic Communications Act is 7-day period and a 30-day refund, as opposed to what is in the Consumer Protection Act, which says 5 days for cancellation and a 15-day for think what is important to note in this particular instance is that even after a consumer has been a purchaser in terms of direct marketing, they still have rights in relation to the right to cancel that contract within 5 days and also receive their money back within 15 days. But there's also an obligation to obviously return the goods to the supplier of that particular product. Now, the other form of marketing that's also dealt with in terms of the app that's considered to be critical is vape marketing in terms of Section 30. So vape marketing is a form of marketing that is employed by a lot of suppliers in order to actually entice consumers to actually come into their premises. But once they're in the premises of the supplier, they then find that the product that they thought was cheap is actually more expensive than what has been advertised. So what the Act stipulates that if there is an advertised price, then the supplier is obliged to provide the consumer with that particular product at the advertised price. Save for in the instance where when the supplier advertises that particular product, it does say, I have a limited supply to this extent. And if it does have that limited supply, then it must sell that product within the confines of that definition in relation to its limit. But a supplier can also be exempt from this particular provision if it does happen that a consumer presents themselves and wants to purchase a product at the advertised price and the product has been sold out. What the supplier can actually do is then they can ask the consumer to get an equivalent product at a reasonable price as a substitute for what was initially advertised. Or alternatively, if the consumer unreasonably refuses to take that product and insists on the initially advertised product, the supplier has the option of obviously referring the consumer to another supplier that is able to provide that product at that price. And if the consumer still refuses to take that product, then the supplier will be exempt from liability in relation to this particular undertaking. The one thing I think that also that needs to be noted in relation to direct marketing as a parting note is that if a direct marketer does deliver goods to a consumer, and the consumer has not requested those specific goods and indicates to the supplier that I have not received this good, but I have not ordered these particular goods, but you have delivered them to me, meaning that the goods are unsolicited. The supplier has an obligation to actually take back those goods within 20 business days. If the supplier fails to arrange for the collection of those goods within the 20 business days, then the consumer has a right to then retain possession of those goods at no cost. So it is important that if they unsolicited goods and a supplier is notified, they must take back those goods within 20 business days. Should they fail to do so, then the consumer will receive those goods and will not be expected to pay for those particular goods because they would have not been solicited by the consumer. The other form of marketing that's anticipated in terms of the Act is in relation to what is called catalog marketing. Catalog marketing is really where an agreement is entered into by phone. It's by a phone call initiated by the consumer, or by fax or postal order, where the consumer does not have an opportunity to inspect those goods. In such a situation, if there is a purchase through these means, then the supplier, the catalog on the marketing, and the supplier must disclose the name and the registration and their license number, their address and the contact details, their sales records, the delivery arrangements, cancellation and return, and exchange policy, and how a consumer can lodge a complaint if they are not satisfied with the goods that they receive in relation to this kind of marketing. The Act is also very clear that any false misleading or deceptive misrepresentations by a supplier or the agent of a supplier can actually have the effect of having the contract of purchase set aside. Specifically, it states that if there is a misrepresentation that is directly or indirectly expressed, or implies the false that has the effect of misleading or being deceptive, or where there's an exaggeration on the capability of that particular product or innuendo or ambiguity, or there is a false or incorrect or misapprehension by the consumer in relation to the capabilities of the product that is being sold, then that particular contract can be set aside in terms of the Act. The one thing that is very important to emphasize in relation to this specific provision is that it is incumbent on a supplier or even their agent to actually correct a misapprehension if a consumer indicates directly that they misunderstand or there is a perception that there is a failure to understand the exact capability of the product places an obligation on the supplier or the agent to correct that misapprehension by the consumer. I think what we found in our current experience to date is that there's a lot of such misapprehensions in relation to sale of new vehicles, sale of different products, whereby a consumer will assume that a motor vehicle is new, whereas we said they're buying a second-hand motor vehicle and they pay the price of a brand new vehicle. And we find that at the end of the day, they don't get full value or the vehicle is not of the quality or standard that is presented to them. We have been, as a commission, we have had some success in relation to making sure that we make sure such contracts are cancelled and justified, because clearly there was a misapprehension on the part of the consumer, and it was incumbent on the supplier of that product to then correct that misapprehension on the part of the consumer. And if they fail to do so, then the consumer cannot be held liable for that particular contract. Now, as a way forward, and what does the Act provide in relation to how we can then make sure that these provisions get full effect and are properly applied in terms of the Consumer Protection Act? The Consumer Protection Act, in terms of Section 82, provides for codes of conduct to be put in place under the auspices of the Commission in relation to different industries, and it also provides for the establishment of office schools. We are in the process of coming up with guidelines that will obviously deal with issues of what would be the terms and conditions that will be put in these codes of conduct. But specifically dealing with the issue of the code of conduct in the advertising industry. We believe that there is a need to specifically review that code of conduct, because currently what it provides is only for one kind of sanction. Where there is misleading advertising, all that the consumer can get today in terms of the code is for that misleading advertising to be removed. But we are saying that the code needs to go a bit further than simply say we must remove that the misleading advertising. We are saying that if a supplier makes misleading advertising, for instance, promises to sell a product at 5 Rand, whereas the product is worth 5,000 Rand, we are saying that that supplier must then be obliged to sell that product at the cost at which it has been advertised, because the consumer has been reduced to contract based on that particular price. So that at the end of the day, advertisers will then be discouraged from actually making incorrect misrepresentations in relation to their product and the quality of their product. So if there is any misleading advertising, we are saying that then that particular supplier must be obliged to sell that product in relation at the price or in the form and quality we say made a misrepresentation to that consumer. But in a nutshell, honorable members and chairperson, we are in the process of obviously having the code put out, the guidelines around the code and the office scheme put out for public comment, and the closing date was the 23rd of May, and we are in the process of finalizing all the inputs that have been made in relation to those codes, in relation to those guidelines, so that we can be put in a position where we can start to accredit the different codes and also accredit the different office schemes. And we have been approached by the Advertising Standards Authority specifically to accredit them in terms of the Consumer Protection Act, so that they would have more power in their hands in relation to the enforcement of the provisions against misleading advertising, meaning that they can impose the penalties that currently exist in terms of the Act, which is obviously making sure that the suppliers comply with the undertakings in terms of the Act. It also allows them to provide compliance notices, consent orders, and where there is a need, it also allows for the Commission jointly with the registered office team to ask for an administrative penalty of up to a million rand or 10% of spending when it's over one of the two is the highest. I thank you, Chairman.
Thank you very much. For the presentation, I don't want to go to the issues of yesterday's agenda. About the presentation, you were not here when it was raised. But remember, that was the presentation. Questions, clarity. Honorable Zondi, Honorable President, Honorable Kekane, Honorable.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me thank the Commissioner for a very lucid presentation. And it raises very interesting me the impression that the commission is a proactive entity. Now, on that score, I'm aware that there are a number of infractions of the legislation out there. False claims, or at least particularly that others have taken care of the newspaper, and a lot of our people are kind of, whether they are promoting medicines that they claim that they have. And a lot of our people get involved in this sort of thing. And in most cases, it is the poor that pay the price. What does the commission do in terms of those things? What about every newspaper you read the way that it has? Identifying things and so on. Dutifully, you complain to the editors, but then you can see that they are just making money in the newspaper. But who are the targets are taking advantage of? Then the second question that I have relates to the accessibility of the commission. How do people access the commission, especially ordinary people? How do they access the commission?
Thank you, Mr. Bondi. Honorable Chair,
right at the beginning, Madam Commissioner. Right at the beginning, where you do a comparison between where you actually mentioned the public sector, you look at complaints of services from public sector, but also from private sector. I don't know if I read you correctly. It looks like you get more complaints from public sector. I wish the outlay was such that you could say, from all the complaints from public sector, this is the percentage. This is the percentage you have solved, and make that comparison to private sector. I'm saying this because there's a research done at MIT, and that research says the country loses $450 billion a year on white collar crime. And you can imagine if that money was part of the budget or was part of the proper economy, how good it could contribute to the economy. Now, I'm so surprised because, look, if in the private sector we're using 450 people on white collar crime, and when this type of reports are given, we don't get the sense that something is done about this particular cost, or we claim it down on it, you get worried because it looks like white collar crime is taking away with wrong things, and it is rather public sector that gets all kinds of howling about corruption and this and that, but private sector is getting cleaned out. So that thing, what is the actual picture that you are thinking about private sector? Because it looks like a lot of things are going wrong. People are not doing things according to the book.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Robert.
Thank you, President. Thank you for your presentation. I'd just like to add to the question of accessibility. I'd just like to know how visible are you? Does the public know of your existence? If you have pamphlets posted that we can maybe use in our constituency offices, that we can make this more, you know, your Royal Commission more known. Then another practical example that I want to ask you, and I want more clarity. What is the definition of consumer? I just need some more clarity on that, because you spoke with two parts for me. the definition of consumer. For example, I pay for my medical aid, I pay, and when I go into the hospital, I've got no choice. And once I'm in hospital, I I've got no choice to argue with the doctor or to how to get information as to what is particularly wrong with me. Whether the service is good or bad, my medical aid will still pay for that service. So, you know, I'm still paying for that service, and there's like, you know, I can't even complain about or ask questions. Secondly, what happens when a child is sick? Another practical example, and we drive really fast for hospital, maybe it's a 1 hour drive, and by the time we get there, the child's getting better. But the doctor sees that, says, oh, the child's better, why do you come here? You know? So I call the medical aid, and I say to the medical aid, did he bill you? Don't pay him. Because he did not serve me in the first, he didn't provide a service to me or to my child. He just said to me, why did you bring this child here? Okay? So then he will then send maybe a debt collector or something to, and then the medical aid is forced to pay. But I'm not happy with the service, the kind of service. So I want you to just define consumers for me, you know, because that definition for me is very broad. Because sometimes we are paying in medical aid, for example, and then the doctors or medical staff will claim from that medical aid, but I have not been satisfied with that type of service. Third is, I read the tech charges on Monday. So I was just wondering, what protection does South Africans have when we are charged by an overseas company? For example, on Monday, article talks about that we are getting emails, would you like your name to be in the who's who in the business? And they say it is free, okay? So, as it was said previously, it would be so gullible, then we then use this email address, and because it's free, then later we find out that we are charged. Okay? And in this article of a businesswoman, she actually found out that she was charged $8.40. She thought it was only going to be $8.40. But I didn't deny it was actually $840 that she was going to be charged. So the bank charged them and said that you were actually overdue by 6,000 rand on the credit card. So now she's fighting for these things because she thought that the email was free and she used this email because it was advertised like that in the newspaper. With the similar that happened to the NGO for disabled people, they did the very same thing when they got an email because they wanted to know who's who, you know, the disability sector, and when they used this email, they then realized that they now have a massive bill to pay, email bill to pay. So, and when they refused to pay it, it was a company from Holland that said, well, then we see you in court. So, I mean, are we then protected from overseas companies? That's basically the question that I'm asking. Are we consumers in South Africa protected from other companies, international companies? And then fourthly, I'd like to know, when I'm a selling fish, who works credit card, for example, they will not give it to me, they will not give me that credit card, unless I call and say, me, Mrs. New York Solution. I say to Uber, stop, look, I'm deaf. I can't use the phone. And it's not, I'm not talking for myself here, I'm talking about many deaf people. We cannot use the phone, and we cannot phone any consumer, we cannot phone, for example, like Uber to say, please send my card to me. And they're telling us, well, they cannot assist us, they will not send our card. The bank, for example, has forced me as a deaf person to use the phone, and I couldn't even hear what they were saying on the other side of the line. So my question is, if we refuse to talk on the phone, and that is the only means to get hold of what we, of the type of services that we want, then that is discrimination against other disabled people. I just want to say that. We have asked staff many a time that I'm a deaf person. If the interpreter's phone for me, they will say that the third party can't use the interpreter to verify your card on the phone.
oppose this bill to an fair practice that is done by the Minister. I don't know whether this can be addressed by you, but I think it's wrong. Whether it's medical aid that falls under one medical scheme, but you have a prescription that is prescribing that you should be given any medication, and the original product. And what is happening today is that when you come there, they refuse to pay, and they are busy pushing us to eat dinner. And I don't know what it is. It's a new phenomenon that is, that's, you know, being introduced to us. And I had a heated argument with one of the farmers, where I was told, because they discovered that I'm a member of parliament, that this is your parliament that is, you know, done with laws. And you see, you can imagine my age, if you give me a generous, it's not right, because scientifically, you know, that is the reason why there's a difference between a generous and a foreign. To find that there is something missing in the generous. And should I die? Because, you know, the medical aid feels that they should buy cheap stuff for us. I really think it's unfair we should take it up. I don't know whether you can address that.
Thank you.
Thank you. One more time.
Thank you very much.
So my contribution on what the Honourable Bernard said in regards to the petition. I just want to check with you, Madam Commissioner, is it possible for us from the level of the petition to submit complaints on behalf of the community? Because in our office, really see that on daily basis we receive complaints from all different people from the community, especially from Guatemala. What normally is done is that when I ask the relevant department or whatever way the problem lies, but after listening to your presentation, in view of much assistance to most of those throughout the tourist community in Guatemala, but I just want to share that maybe we are the first person in the city who will be allowed to do a clearance from that. And in addition to that, I think if for now we don't have that relationship with constituents or something, I think the kind of work that you are doing really needs us. We really need you. We need each other. You need to create a kind of a good relationship with us. And maybe you take all the constituent administrators, maybe you liaise with us as a member of parliament, you take them to a workshop for what kind of work you are doing. And I also think that what kind of us also needs this kind of a workshop that you are doing. The kind of the information that you have given us today is very, very much important to me, and it needs down there. I can give you an example that for example, in my office currently we have a similar case whereby the richest travel office, the market case, has evicted people through Red M. The case we just came with Red M, they evicted people. Those people have stamp cards that say we are not there illegally. We are given authority to stay here by the tribal office in this village. Therefore, even if there's a problem somewhere in the Yaren, but those people are poor victims. They were there legally according to them because they had no proof that we went to the tribal office. We are given this health card that we are approved, we can go and stay in house and in the tent number, so and so. But because we have this, we have big money, we have come with the right hands and the big people. What happened then? Good for all of those people, their chefs were well fed,
they lost all their constraints of staff, everything. They lost almost everything. As we speak, some of them, they don't even have a place to stay now. Some of them are staying in their police station, in their community ones, because of that. But they have went to land affairs, all government institutions, looking for assistance, and that's why we cannot get them. That's what I'm saying. Can we be their spokesperson, or they must come directly?
Thank you, Honourable Member. I don't see any further help. But my question is just a very simple one. If you have asked one thing, how far is the Commission utilizing community meetings as one thing? To say or to pass a message. As we have been communicating this morning, whether you do use the community meeting for treatment and the broadcasting. The second issue that I know that you are in a process of finalizing the MOU and the application of some of the developmental bodies. How that process goes. I'm not raising that because of the past week or so, we have seen that it has been put in place to the customs and the regulator having their own current hearing for the current one. And there is no quick alignment. It might cause some challenges. In the industry and so on. They have to try to track their progress around those particular matters. But the other thing is that this thing of advertising with the affluent women or young men by the ad. What to take the commission around those particular issues and so on. I know that it might be part of ASA currently as a central regulatory agency. What is your take around that, those particular issues?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Specifically be looking into those kinds of industries and how we can come up with a strategy to
to make sure that these kind of abusive doses continue to take place. But we believe that the best mechanism is to put in place a code so that if there is a party or an entity that transgresses, then we'll be able to enforce that particular code in relation to that particular transgression. With your permission, Chair, I think I'll just deal with all the medical questions, because there are quite a few questions in relation to the medical industry. There's also been quite a substantial number of complaints in relation to medical aid. Now, the issue around medical aid is specifically around the rules of the medical aid. We found that the rules of the medical aid are very complex and they're very tricky. Even we as a commission, when we sit down and try and understand and analyze the terms and conditions of the medical aid, we do not understand. We've had meetings with the Council for Medical Aid team. They come back to us and said, no, this industry is very technical and the kind of information that they give cannot be simplified. We as a commission are not going to accept it, because the Act is very clear. It says that all contracts that consumers enter into must be in plain and simple language. So we do not believe that it's anything that is that complex, even written by a human being, it is capable of simplification. So we have made it quite clear to the Council for Medical Aid Scheme that we are now going to take it upon ourselves to engage with the medical aid to ensure that this language is simplified and made user-friendly for consumers, because at the end of the day, people are signing on to medical aid when they don't even understand the terms and conditions. Now the issue around medical aid is around your savings vis-a-vis the actual medical aid. In a lot of cases, you find that you've used your medical aid 3 or 4 times and they say to you that your savings have been exhausted. No one can actually explain to you the costing, how deductions are made, and the timeline around the specific issue. We are saying that we should simplify, because we've had a few complaints from people who are from the agents who are arguing that they are on chronic medication. Now it is critical that they should have access to medication for the duration of their membership to their medical aid. So you find that before they can even get their full allocation, the savings have been used up, the allocation has been used up, and then they cannot get access to critical medication. And then it then defeats the actual purpose of having access to your medical aid. So we are now saying that we need to fix these issues, there needs to be simplification, there needs to be explanation. Now, in relation to persons with disabilities, I think I'll also those issues in relation to the complaints that we all actually received, because the people who have been very pushy with regards to the terms and conditions of medical aid are the agents, because they say it's not even an issue of being able to communicate with the medical aid. Even the manner in which these terms and conditions are presented in such a way that they cannot read them. The font is too small, closed, they don't understand, they need to have font that is, you know, that is much of a bigger print, where they can properly understand and interpret the kind of language. Even the length of the document is too much for them to actually look at. So this is one of the investigations we're actually advocating in order to make sure that there is clarity in relation to this, and make sure that there is a code of conduct that will then be put in place that will be applicable to all medical aid. But the one thing I'd like to say is that some of the medical aids have been very proactive, and they come forth to us and they say, let us work together in order to try and simplify the terms and conditions and make sure that they are user-friendly in order that they can be properly consumed. Now, the issue around doctors and doctors not providing a proper service in relation to what a consumer is actually paying for. In that context, we have had instances, in fact, I can remember distinctly one case that has come before the commission, where a person was actually complaining about the issue of charging by a doctor. They say they attended a medical examination by the doctor. It was a one-off medical examination. Then what happened is that when the doctor submitted the case to the medical aid, they exaggerated the amount that was involved in relation to that particular medical examination. We have successfully compelled that particular doctor to actually reverse that particular charge that was given to that particular medical aid, because the service that was charged for was not at the amount that had been presented by the doctor to that particular consumer. So in instances where you are not happy with the service that you're getting from the doctor, we believe that the best, what the commission would recommend is that you actually pay for that service so that you obviously don't get that diagnosis. But then you bring a complaint to the commission, we will then intervene on your behalf to make sure that you get your refund and you're only charged for a service where you are satisfied with the quality of service that you receive, so that we can obviously deal with that particular the one thing I think is that's important to emphasize is that we have jurisdiction over professionals as well. Meaning, if you don't get a proper service from a doctor or a lawyer or even a professional association of practitioners, we have jurisdiction to actually address that specific issue and compel them to comply with their code of ethics. And I believe that this conduct by this doctor of saying that the child is not sick and they're not providing with a service that they're charging is contrary to the code of ethics in the medical profession. In relation to the issue around medical aids and generic drugs and the issue around original drugs, that one is an issue that I believe we need to get some clarity on with regard from the medical aid as to why it is they compel consumers to actually take generic drugs when a consumer is actually paid to receive original drugs. Because from what we understand, if a consumer, what happens is when a prescription is issued out to a consumer, the consumer will make a decision on whether they get a generic drug or they get an original medication. If there is a provision in terms of the medical aid scheme, or the rules of the medical aid that compel the consumer to actually take generic drugs as opposed to original drugs, then the commission does have the right to actually look into the correctness of that particular provision. Because the Act is very clear that if a consumer enters into a contract, the commission has the right to actually review those contract terms and conditions. And if it is found that those contract terms and conditions are unfair, and as we indicated, Honourable Member, that it actually has an impact on one's health, then we have every right to actually intervene and compel that regulator to actually change those terms and conditions. But over and above that, what the Act does require us to do as a commission is that if there is any conduct or any form of treatment or any form of service that is being provided that has an impact on one's state of health, then we actually have the power to ask that particular product be recalled. And we then make it incumbent on the supplier of the product to then come to us and prove that product is not necessarily harmful to human health. So if we could have something in writing from yourself in relation to the complaint and the instances where you have been compelled to actually take generic drugs as opposed to original drugs, then we'll be able to intervene on your behalf, and then we'll also have an opportunity to look at the rules of your medical aid to check whether or not they don't have the impact of actually compelling consumers to take products that they believe are inferior to what they actually would require, and would obviously compel that medical aid to change their terms and conditions. I think that disposes or that addresses all the complaints in relation to medical and pharmaceutical. Now, the question around accessibility of information. I think there's one thing that maybe I may have omitted to indicate when I commenced my presentation. We have the National Consumer Commission, but we also have provincial consumer protection offices. Even though we have oversight in relation to those particular offices and the services that they deliver, they are funded through the provincial government and not through the national. So because of that, there is the element of concurrence of jurisdiction, in the sense that even though we have the right to obviously have a presence in the provinces that we work with these offices, we obviously have to work through the MEC, or let me say MINMAC, to make sure that policies of the Commission are properly implemented. And it's currently, you actually have a situation whereby we have one national legislation and then nine different pieces of provincial legislation that also deal with consumer protection. So what we are now trying to advocate for is that we should have only one law that applies in relation to consumer protection, which is the national legislation on consumer protection. So at the end of the day, even though they're provincial offices, both offices will only have oversight in relation to and will also deal with issues of staff. But in relation to policies, implementation, and all such other issues, they are answerable to the NEC. So, in a nutshell, what I'm trying to say, the NEC only has national presence, and that is in Pretoria, but we're in the process of rolling out our business plan. And in terms of our business plan, we are planning on actually having what we call volunteers in the province. What we intend on doing is recruiting unemployed graduates in community to actually come to the commission, be trained around the consumer protection act, be trained around issues of dispute resolution, so that they end up being our foot soldiers on the ground. And we'll make sure that the people we recruit are the people from those specific areas and those specific provinces, so that we don't have a situation whereby we ship in people and then they're unable to communicate to those specific communities. So we want people from those communities, but we would like them to be as unemployed graduates, because obviously there's challenges about the employment of unemployed graduates, so we believe that would obviously be help contributing towards helping with regard to the unemployment crisis. But at the end of the day, we believe that it is our mechanism by which we can actually make sure that there are foot soldiers on the ground and working. Now, the proposal that we use constituency offices, I believe that this is one that we really welcome. Because the approach that, in fact, what has happened since the establishment of the commission, we have been approached by the national, what can I call it, the traditional leaders, it's the House of Traditional Leaders. Yes. They have said to us, they have offices of that are that reside in all the different traditional houses. But now the challenge they have is that they don't have resources, in the sense that they don't have infrastructure, they don't have fax machines, they don't have computers, they don't have email, etc. So what they have proposed is that we work in conjunction with them. They will make the offices available, they will make the community services accessible to us, and then we obviously use the infrastructure in order to, and then we provide the infrastructure, meaning the fax machines, the computers, the chairs, the tables, etc., etc. And then our volunteers that are on the ground would then have access to the community through the House of Traditional Leaders. But we are obviously willing to explore other avenues in relation to constituency offices. It is an issue that we had not canvassed because obviously there was a specific proposal on the table, but it is something we will look into. And material is available from the commission. If we can get a specific request as to the amount, the quantity, will make material available to constituency offices for institution. Because the more we can get the word of the commission out, the more we'll be able to achieve in terms of our mandate. The issue around emphasizing public sector complaints vis-a-vis private sector complaints. I take the point that yes, in my presentation there was an emphasis in relation to public sector complaints vis-a-vis the private sector complaints. This is because on the ground, to be quite honest, the reality is the majority of the complaints we have received is in relation to the municipal services that are being provided. But having said that, we did not have a commission then sit back and say there's this problem and we're just going to simply shout from the rooftops and come up with a resolution. We have approached the different municipalities. We've entered into a memorandum of understanding of how we work together, and we have structured a method by which we are able to now resolve complaints within a period of 7 days. So we believe that the commission, we have actually gone some way in actually assisting the municipalities to not only resolve those complaints, but to better communicate the message. Because what we discovered in these discussions with the municipalities was that the challenge here is that it's not that complaints are not being resolved, but once they are resolved, it's not being properly communicated back to the consumers that this is what has been done, and these are the steps that will be undertaken in order to make sure that in the future these transgressions don't occur. So because of the intervention and engagement with the commission, we will obviously we believe that we'll obviously be able to resolve quite a number, and we will be able to map the way forward in relation to these matters. But another issue I think we need to also be alive to is, yes, true as you'd like to put it, there is a lot of transgressions from the private sector. And I think I've been quoted quite a number of times speaking about the ICT sector, because they're the second largest transgressor. We get a lot of complaints about mobile, the services that they're providing, the lack of quality of service and issues around that of that nature. So the commission has also equally been vocal in relation to those kinds of complaints. And I believe that even on the ICASA question, Chairperson, we have actually had players in the ICT space actually coming forth and being receptive to the work of the commission and working hand in hand with the commission. But having said that, there are those obviously who are trying to be resistant, but we believe that the Consumer Protection Act gives us the tools and the method by which we can obviously deal with these issues, because we have an obligation to actually deal with these issues, whether or not there is a sector regulator. And obviously that will be the position up until such time as the minister grants an exemption, if at all he does grant an exemption at some future point in time. In relation to the issue around overseas companies, And obviously charges that are being levied and consumers obviously being overcharged as a consequence of that. The Act actually the Consumer Protection Act has actually a very good and innovative provision in relation to entities that may not have a geographic presence, well, where the head office may not be geographically located in South Africa. What the Act stipulates is that in relation to a transgression against the consumer, there will be what is called strict liability. So if there is even a service provider within the South African context that is providing that particular service, in terms of the Consumer Protection Act, they can be held liable. Because what the Act states is that any person in the value chain in relation to the production of a service or provision of a particular goods to a consumer, that individual can be held liable even if they have a very minor role. So for a consumer to actually have access to those particular emails, there is clearly some service provider within the South African context that is providing that particular information to the consumer. So if we could get the relevant information, we would then make that service provider liable, even if the product that is being purchased is a product that is provided overseas. Because the Act very clearly states that if it's a transaction that's undertaken within the South African context, no matter where in the value chain, if there is one service provider in that value chain that is located in South Africa, then we have the right to assume jurisdiction and we will hold that one service provider liable in terms of the provisions of that Act. I mean, in terms of the provisions of the Consumer Protection Act. So if we could get the relevant details, we would then obviously do the relevant investigation and then deal with that to that service provider. In relation to the issues around the credit card and the call center, I must say I was not aware that this kind of practice is taking place, that they only accept voice communication as a method by which one can confirm the identity. I was of the impression that they also accept electronic written communication. But in that particular case, I think it's something that we need to look into. And the method by which we as a commission will holistically deal with challenges that persons with disability are actually encountering is by putting in place a standing committee. In fact, one of the issues in terms of our business plan is that we plan on putting in place standing committees to deal with various issues on an ongoing basis, because we believe that as a commission, we run the risk that in going on with our day-to-day responsibilities, we will lose track of issues that are on the ground. So what we've decided to do is that we plan on putting in place standing committees. And among the standing committees, well, we have three standing committees. Among the standing committees we will have is one that will deal with what is called vulnerable consumers. Now, in terms of the Consumer Protection Act, vulnerable consumers are defined as consumers who live in rural areas, in peri-urban areas, women, persons with disabilities, and persons who have a challenge with regard to literacy. So what we plan on doing is having a standing committee that will, on an ongoing basis, raise concerns that affect vulnerable consumers, make reports to the commissioner, who will then be duty-bound to put in place interventions to actually deal with those specific issues. And on an annual basis, the Act obliges us to write a report to the minister as to what steps and interventions we have put in place in order to address concerns of these vulnerable consumers. And the way we anticipate this committee will be constituted is that we will have representatives from all the nine provinces, and I'm on a roadshow speaking to the different MEPs of the provinces to request that they nominate individuals. But over and above that, with regard to specific vulnerable groups, which is persons with disabilities, women, persons with literacy challenges, we are going to invite NGOs that specifically emphasize with dealing with those specific groups to also have a representation of this committee, which is anticipated will meet four times a year, and the chairperson will then prepare a report to the commissioner on how we should intervene and deal with this specific issue. So what I would like to request the honourable member to do is to send me an email on this specific issue, and we will obviously then have to do an assessment, and it will indicate which bank it is, so that we can, well, I think you spoke about Woolworths, if I'm not mistaken. So that we can obviously identify and enter into an engagement with Woolworths. We believe maybe it's an even bigger problem than just the two Woolworths. So we then have to conduct a relevant research on the matter, and then where necessary, we'll put a code of conduct in place on how such entities must communicate with persons with disabilities. The issues around cheap shops This is something that has been raised with me in my current position when I did road shows with the nine provinces this last year. That it is not only the cheap shops, but it is the cheap shops that I don't know if I'm allowed to specifically use this language, but this is what has been raised with us by the community. They refer to shops that are owned by Pakistanis, Pakistani retailers, by Somali retailers. I hope I will not be characterized as xenophobic because I'm just simply reiterating what has been raised with the commission. And they indicated that in a lot of these instances, they are sold products of an inferior quality. They are sold products that have passed their sell-by date. Now, you will note that when I spoke about specific industries that we're investigating, I also spoke about the retail and manufacturing industry, which is one, that is the reason why we're looking at that industry, is obviously to deal with these substandard products that are being sold in these industries. But the approach that the commission will be taking is in relation to what the powers that we have in terms of the Act. The Act says all products must be labeled, all products must be properly priced, and all products must be healthy for human consumption. So what we're going to have to do is go to the Department of Health, go with the health inspector, and do an assessment on whether the conditions under which these products are being sold are healthy, and also make an assessment whether they're properly priced and whether they're properly used. If it is found that there's no proper labeling, there's no proper pricing, and health conditions are not acceptable, the Act does allow the commission to then confiscate those particular products and then start a process in terms of which they would want, in terms of which we can then have the trading license of that particular vendor revoked. So that is the approach that we intend on taking. But having said that, Honourable Member, I do note that then you will be called by the very same Honourable Members complaining that the constituencies are saying that Commission is targeting SMMEs and all sorts of other things. But there is no other way we can deal with it other than through this process. But we'll obviously be mindful of the issues, the societal issues around that. But we are in a catch-22 situation because people who are like the entities or traders or licensed businesses are the SMMEs who government is encouraging to set up this business and continue to trade. But it's a difficult balancing situation and we believe we need to protect the interests of consumers. Issues except for your question, the ones around whether the community media is being used to communicate our message. We are using community media, but we are using the electronic media. We actually have regular slots on trading, on Shabu and then RSG, radio station. There we have ongoing discussions with them. Radio stations like Tobela, there's been some, we've only watched that one or two. They haven't been very enthusiastic in coming to the party. We've also found that even radio stations that communicate in Chibenda and Chisona have not been very enthusiastic. But I do believe maybe it is a transgression on the part of the commission in the sense that maybe you find that the language, we do not have staff that effectively communicate in the required language. In fact, I think it's a reflection on myself because in a lot of the interviews, they request that the commissioner specifically come and do the interview. And I believe that they are not very excited at the prospect of the commissioner coming through and then speaking in Sotho, whereas the language of communication is Tshivenda or Tshitsonga. But we have found that in the Sotho and the Nguni language stations, we have there's been a good reception in the sense that I'm obviously fluent in both Nguni languages and Sotho languages. But we will obviously make an effort to make sure that the message is communicated in all the language stations in the South African context. The one media we haven't been using from a community point of view is the print media, but we take the point that the chairperson has raised and we will obviously be looking towards using the print media, especially with regard to community print media on an ongoing basis. Now, the last question around the codes of conduct and when they will be finalized. We do accept that we are behind schedule, but this is a process that was started late in the day. In fact, it was started as soon as I came into office. But we are trying to expedite it. As I have already indicated, we put out the guidelines for the codes of public comment, and we had initially had a closing date of April. The comment came back and requested that the closing date be extended to May. We extended it to the 20th of May, and we're in the process of consolidating and finalizing those the guidelines. Then we'll start the process of inviting specific codes to be submitted, and we'll start the process of approving codes and accrediting all those things and finalizing that. But we do expect that it will take us the next 2 to 3 months, because we are still in the process of identifying permanent premises for the commission. But currently we are still quoting at DTR, but we have every intention of having our permanent offices by the 1st of August, so that all the systems of the commission can start working properly, and that we can then recruit all the relevant staff to occupy the commission, or to occupy the vacant commission. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. I thought that we are closing, but I see a follower. Honorable, report from him.
Sorry, Chair, I'm not going to ask you one question. So not just one question. So public using public transport, whether it's the bus or the train or taxi, the complaints coming from them as well, that's just a question that I wanted to ask.
No, I don't believe we've received any complaints from the public using public transport about the quality of the region. It's really in relation to people buying vehicles which have presented as being brand new or as a second hand. I think that's basically what we received from the motor industry, but not the public, the public that uses public transport. We haven't received any complaints.
Thank you, Commissioner. I could see that you are using mostly the public broadcaster or the community radio station. All the ones you have listed are not all the public broadcaster, but at least we are utilizing some of them. I hope the other issues which need to be addressed when the study bodies and the sector participation going forward, which we are engaging at the door. Members, if there is no question, I will just try to go through what we have requested me to do yesterday by the member, which will read as follows. The portfolio committee on communication, after having received presentation on the 14th and 15th of June 2011 from the following institutions, MTDA, ACA, ASPA, and NCC, recommends the following. 1. MBDA and ACA must meet, discuss, consider and take all issues raised by community and small commercial media and the oversight duties forward, then report them to the committee. Secondly, the MEC Charter Council should have review mechanisms to include experiences encouraging media development and diversity. This may include industry business practices like percentage commitment of tax spend to community media as defined in the MPDA Act. Thirdly, the committee will engage DTI regarding promulgating the next charter to the next step, Chapter 9, as suggested by ACA. Fourthly, DCI has to commit and implement a percentage expense to community media as defined by MDDAF and small commercial media. Six, DCI must support the MDDA proposal for establishing a community radio software management tool to enhance professionalism, accountability, record keeping, reporting and good community radio management. Seven, the committee will review progress around all the above issues in this regard. I hope members will agree if we are saying at the end of the financial year, so that there is more time of engagement. Unless members will want us to get a midterm review of that somewhere around the October, November, so that we are able to access your relevant process. But so far, we're saying all these issues that we'll be able to come back to us at the end of the financial year. We are further saying government organs of states and state-owned entities are encouraged to use community and small commercial media as defined by the MDPA Act in respect of their advertising advertising spend. This will not only ensure their message reaches the targeted communities, but will also support the ideal of sustaining a diverse media society, viable community media, and enhanced democracy. The last issue is that as the committee will urge the NCC to speed up the application and conclusion of MOU with the sector and self-regulatory bodies. Is there anything which you want to say, Member Borma, or we ask you? What other would you
say? I think Chapter 20 agrees that in terms of the report, I think it must be around the September.
MPA, can you do that? ACA?
In terms of mid-term review, we will be able to.
I'm not sure what mid-term means, but we need progress to that. Okay.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much.
So we agree. We'll change the wording around that particular issue before the committee for public campaign. Thank you very much, committee, again for the short notice that you have given us. We'll continue to engage you in particular. Maybe we might revoke the accounting mechanism of Parliament of oversight, where we might want to get a report from the commissioner before anything comes for us, so that we know how accurate in terms of the provision and the other things. But we continue engaging with it to make sure that we can get the access around this issue, so that as they come before us, we are waiting for. I hope at one point you'll be also informed, because we are all consumers. And the government department are supposed and entities are supposed to provide services to all of us. I'm not sure how long it's going to take to evaluate whether a department does provide the service to the consumer as required and so on. But I know that other department will declare themselves as consumer for others. That will complicate things and so on. But thank you very much again for the presentation and so on. Members, thank you very much.